Erickson, from assistant professor from Stanford University. Also interesting, he's in the School of Public Health Life, PhD in economics, and he's flown here from DC because he's currently on the National Bureau of Economic Research. Advising literally national economic policy while taking a sabbatical from Stanford. So thank you to Eric for coming to chat with us.
Well, thanks for having me here today. Econometrics, the title of the talk is Econometrics for Anesthesiologists. It's a econometrics is a fancy word for statistics, so my goal here is to provide sort of a high-level view of some of the things I think about. Obviously, in half an hour, we're not turning anyone to sort of a statistician, but just to give you a high-level view, mostly to have you just to put things in your mind when you think about study design, things that I think might be helpful to you. In August, they asked me to join the staff of the Council of Economic Advisors, which I started that job in September. They don't give a whole lot of notice. Basically, for those who don't know, the Council of Economic Advisors, it's one of the federal agencies within the executive office of the president, so ultimately we're advising the president on policy. It's good work, it's fun work, it's interesting work. Happy to talk more about it afterwards, but it does impose some things that I have to do, so I have to let you all know that I'm speaking here today. In my capacity as an assistant professor at Stanford, the work I'm discussing, it's obviously outside of my work for the council, and certainly nothing I'm saying here should be construed as representing anything, the views of the federal government or the administration. So other disclosures, I guess, no conflicts of interest really to report. I do have a K award from NIDA. So if, in case you're wondering where the title of the talk came from, this is all the way back, Harry Truman. There's a bowling alley in the building I work in that's named after him. But give me a one-handed economist. All the economists say on the one hand or the other. So we are double-dealing people, apparently. Just a little cute thing I'll talk about real fast. It's kind of econometrics. It's kind of economics. But this is a little paper we did way back. We've all seen this graph, right? Opioid sales, opioid deaths, they've been increasing. And so sort of an interesting question you might ask is there's chronic opioid users, we'll call them, and then there's low opioid users, right? People who don't use a lot of opioid. And so you might ask yourself, well, this growth that I'm seeing here, is it because of the chronic users or is it because of the low users, right? Is it because we've seen more chronic users than before or is it because we've seen more low users? That'd be one question. And then you could ask yourself, is it also, if I look at chronic users, is it because they're using more? Or is it that if I look at the low users, are they losing more, right? So there's four things, right? There's number of chronic users, number of low users that could be driving this graph. And then there's the amount of opioids used by the low users and the chronic users, right? So four things, you might say, what's important, right? Because that is an important question, right? For example, a lot of state laws right now are targeting acute use, basically, right, on limits on opiate prescribing. But if you think all this growth is due to chronic users, then those laws are probably not really targeting the right people. So there's important policy implications. So just simple math, right? So if I look at opiate use in 2013, so that has to be N there is the number of chronic users times the amount the chronic users are using plus the number of low users times the amount the low users are using, right? It's got to be true. That also must be true in 2001, and so just do a little bit of algebra here. And you can actually get this, is that, we don't need to talk, it's just simple algebra, but you can actually decompose exactly then how much of the growth in use is due to each of these four things here. Just simple algebra, so one of the nice things economists, we really, that's all we do, algebra, really. And basically you do that, that's fancy math, but the math kind of tells you what this chart tells you. So that top line there, the top line there is the, so basically these two lines here are going to be growth in chronic users, and these two lines here are acute users. So what this tells you is, the story is the story of the chronic users, right? Because that line is going up, the number of chronic users. And that's what we found. So we published a paper on that. I'm having a little trouble advancing this. Is it stuck? Uh-oh. Calling a consult here. It's just like literally frozen.
Yeah, because it's right? Am I doing something wrong? Okay, well that advanced. Okay, so look at that. Okay. Oh, really? Okay. Me too, so. Alrighty, so long story short is, you know, we basically 90%. So 90% of the growth that we're seeing in opioid use is due to chronic users. So, that 90%, half of it is due to the increase in the number of users, and half of it is due to the fact that chronic users are using more than they used to. So, simple paper we did way back in the day that we were able to publish there in Annals of Internal Medicine. So, we go into sort of econometrics and how it can be useful more generally. I'd like to talk about, first of all, why do we care about retrospective observational studies, and then sort of, like I said, give you an overview of some of the econometric methods that I use. So it looks like I just got to do, hold on. So when we think about clinical trials, which for most of us, you know, we're taught in med school are the gold standard for figuring things out. So the key benefit of clinical trials is the internal validity, right? So you have randomization, so that assures that on average the treatment and the control groups are the same. And so internal validity says that the answer that you get from a clinical trial is quote unquote the right answer. Right, but the key drawback is external validity, which is a question of, you know, can I apply those results to other populations? And so there are some issues. So first of all, clinical trials tend to be a fairly homogenous population. That's one of them. Some other things, clinical trials tend not to address the real world concerns, such as costs and how people are going to interact with the healthcare system. And we'll talk about this a little bit more. The machinery of the trials ensure that the population in a clinical trial is always going to be very different from a real-world population. And references there. That first one is my PhD advisor, who's also my boss now. So had to cite him. All righty. So limitations of clinical trials. So way back when I was at RAND for a couple years in Los Angeles, and so I'm told that, you know, whenever any show comes out, it's like shown before a test audience, and they get feedback from the test audience. And so let's think about how that test audience will compare to sort of the general viewing population. And so I think there are two big reasons why it's different. And the first is, you know, so I never went to these things, right? So why didn't I find out about, why didn't I go to them? Well, because first of all, I didn't know about them, right? And so my general sense is that people who go to the studio test audience tend to have some kind of connection to the entertainment industry. But the second thing why I didn't go to them is because I just don't like TV that much. So those of you in LA know, like, for me to go to one of these things, living, you know, sort of on the west side of LA, it's probably an hour in traffic to get there. Then I got to watch the thing. Then I got to, like, answer some questions about it. Then I spend an hour going back home, right? So that's not how I want to spend 4 or 5 hours. But, you know, some people like TV, right? So the point is that the only people who go are the people who like TV. So, you know, the bottom line is that if you think about it, there's some selection bias into who goes into a trial always. So even though this trial gets sort of a certain type of selection bias, you have this other form of selection bias, and that people who watch TV, who go to these studio test things, they have to be people who like TV a lot. And similarly, people who go into a trial have to be people who think that the trial is going to be beneficial or who are going to care more than the average population. And so that's basically the point I'm trying to make here. So, you know, who enrolls in a trial? They have to have found out about the trial. They have to be willing to enroll. Typically, that's going to be someone who's more motivated than the average patient. And they have to be more open to the therapy to begin with. So, for example, in the world of pain, you know, if you want to do a clinical trial, let's say cognitive behavioral therapy versus opioids or something like that, you know, the guy who thinks CBT is junk is not signing up for that trial, right? But realize that's important, because from a policy perspective, if I want to, you know, lower payments, you know, make it easier for people to, you know, enroll in CBT, lower co-payments, I have to think, well, you know, what's that guy who thinks it's junk? How's that going to affect him, right? And, you know, what is it going to work for him? Some of the machinery of trials tends to exacerbate these differences. So, for example, I think a lot of us know, if you enroll people, it's expensive to lose them, and so trials do a lot to keep them from losing people. So one is a lot of trials, particularly for chronic medications, have run-in periods where you have to have been compliant. Say if it's a trial for diabetes medication, you have to be compliant on the diabetes medication for a couple months before you can even be in the trial. So again, they're trying to get people who aren't going to drop out. But, you know, again, in the real world, we have to think about people who drop out. And also sort of once you enroll in the trial, you know, you tend to have people who try to remind you and, you know, encourage you to stay compliant. So, again, those are things that sort of, you know, separate a trial from sort of the real world. I always like to think of it as, you know, in a clinical trial as much as possible, because, and, you know, it's important. I mean, this is what you want to do, but as much as possible, you're trying to treat people like lab rats, right? You're trying to do a lot of things to minimize the influence of the real world. But the problem is we live in the real world, and that may limit the ability to apply the findings of a trial to the real world. So for that reason, secondary data like MPOG and sort of retrospective analysis, they may be better able to address effectiveness because they are rooted in the real world, right? And so that's why they may be effective, but then the key thing, of course, is the internal validity and addressing bias. So let's talk about that. So we'll start with this big primer on how I think about bias. So let's think about the problem and then let's think about the solutions. So when I explain bias to people, I always like to think about this little story. So let's say it's July 2, I'm working with the CA1. You know, CA1 sees a low MAP, you know, and wants to treat the blood pressure, push a little phenylephrine, right? Sounds like a good idea, but, you know, unfortunately for this CA1, I'm there attending, and I'm going to haze them a little bit on their second day of residency. So they're pushing the Neo, and kind of unbeknownst to them, even as they're pushing the Neo, I'm pushing a little bit of nipride, right? So, yeah. Why are you all laughing? That's not funny. So let's think about this. Now, we know the true effect of the Neo that I'm pushing is to raise the blood pressure. We also know the confounding effect of the nipride that I'm pushing is to lower the blood pressure, and let's just assume it cancels out. So what the CA1 is going to see is absolutely nothing going on. They're going to freak out, right? Now, I could also haze the CA1 in a different direction. So let's say it's a low blood pressure and, you know, he pushes some Neo, and unbeknownst to him, I gave like double, right? Double what he gave. And so, right, we know that sort of the true effect is going to be some increased blood pressure. We know the confounding effect, what I'm giving, is going to really jack up the blood pressure. The CA1's going to be wondering what is going on, right? Welcome to anesthesia. So, this example, I think, is helpful, I think, because it tells some things when we think about bias, okay? The first is, for bias to be important, the confounder has to be unobserved. So the key thing here is, obviously, the CA1 didn't see what I was doing, right? Because if the CA1 saw what I was doing, the CA1 would say, oh, okay, well, you know, the blood pressure didn't change, but that's because I saw my attending pushing nipride. So obviously, I know, you know, but I know the Neo works, I just, my attending was doing something that was also driving the blood pressure down. So first of all, the confounder has to be unobserved. The second is that the confounder has to be correlated with the treatment. So again, the key thing here is that every time the CA1 is pushing the Neo, I'm pushing nipride, right? If I'm just pushing nipride randomly, the CA1 is still going to see the true effect of the Neo, right? They have to be simultaneous. So that has to be correlated. And I think the second point is that it's always helpful, you know, to think about how the confounder is working, and because that helps you sign the bias, right? So we know that in the case of nipride, the bias is going downwards, right? The effect I see is going to be less than the true effect. On the other hand, we know that if I'm pushing Neo, the bias is going to be upwards because the observed effect is going to be more than the true effect. Okay, so that's how we think about bias, and so how can we deal with it, right? So that's sort of what I try to do with my studies and what most of us try to do. So to me, there's just two things. Again, going back to this example, first you can control for the bias, which is basically for the CA1. In this example, that would mean for the CA1 to sort of, you know, watch what I'm doing more carefully, right? So we'll talk about that and ways to do that. And the second thing is you can eliminate the bias. And so the CA1 could always, you know, give me a little IM succinylcholine. That'll solve that issue right there. But right, so you can either say the bias is there, I'm going to observe it and adjust for it, or you can say I'm going to find ways to get rid of it. Okay, there's two ways of dealing with the problem. So we'll talk about controlling for bias, and you know, I think it might be helpful to talk about pluses and minuses. So as economists, we're always thinking about costs and benefits. So controlling for bias, again, similar, we have to think about costs and benefits. So, you know, controlling for bias, again, is just identify possible confounders, observe them, and try to net out their potential effect. And the potential cost is always going to be a decreased effective sample size. So what do I mean by that? Well, you know, suppose I want to look at, you know, I want to see if height affects survival for ICU patients, right? So we'll just say there's short and tall patients. And suppose, you know, I went through some, you know, database and I had 100,000 ICU patients, 50,000 tall, 50,000 short, right? That sounds pretty good, right? And that's a pretty large sample for looking at mortality. Good statistical power, right? Everyone would say that's a great sample size. All right. But now let's say, you know, I want to control for race, right? So, you know, white or Asian, right? Why not? So, because I think it's a potential confounder, and so we'll just assume that most whites are tall and most Asians are short. And so let's think about now what it means to control. Well, if you think about it, I can't just compare tall to short now, because since most whites are tall and most Asians are short, if I'm comparing just tall people to short people, implicitly I'm also comparing white to Asian, right? And, you know, the effect of race is something I'm trying to adjust for. So if you think about how you would do this, this just goes back to the scientific method. I have to change one thing at a time, right? So again, in comparing tall to short, I'm also comparing white to Asian. So the right way to do it then is I have to change one thing at a time. So I have to compare tall whites to short whites, tall Asians to short Asians. Now I can get again at the effect of height, right? But the problem then is, right, by definition, I told you most Asians were short and most whites were tall. So if I'm comparing tall whites to short whites and tall Asians to short Asians, there aren't as many of those people, right? I need the exceptions to the rule, basically. Now my sample size is going to be driven by how many short white people I have and how many tall Asians I have. And I remember, I told you by definition, those people are rarer. So the bottom line is, basically, my 100,000 person sample size has dropped, effectively, right? Because basically, my ability to find a statistically significant effect, I need a lot of these people who are exceptions to the rule. So that's always going to be the cost when it comes to adjusting and controlling for bias. Basically, a smaller effective sample size, you know, bigger standard errors, and bigger p-values. So I'm old enough to remember this statement and been around, you know, we think about controlling for bias, but this is our Secretary of Defense back in the day, but he talks about known knowns. Those are the things we know, then there are the known unknowns, that is to say there are some things we know we do not know, but then there are unknown unknowns, the ones we know we don't know we don't know, right? I'm old enough to remember that, but... So I think that's helpful to characterize the potential biases you might think you come across. So most studies I think that I've seen, you know, are typically going to control and adjust for observable characteristics. So a known known is something you know could be a bias, and it's something that you can actually measure, right? It's a known known. You know that it's a problem, and you know how to deal with it, right? So, you know, with an MPOG, again, those are things that are pretty easy to adjust for. So MPOG reports age, reports sex. You know, you can get observable indicators of health, such as the presence of various comorbidities, right? So there's the known knowns. But then the interesting question is, what about the known unknowns and the unknown unknowns? Can you get at those? And the answer is that MPOG, actually, because of its richness, does allow you to get at that. So. Basically, you know, again, we don't have to get into the weeds of what these things are, but physician fixed effects, hospital fixed effects, year fixed effects will help you adjust for an observable characteristics that are unique to the physician, the hospital, and the year. So again, that's the way you can improve the internal validity of your studies to use these type of things. Then again, the nice thing about MPOG is, you know, very rich detail, reports a lot of things, so allows you to adjust for that and improve the validity of your study. I guess I'm supposed to talk about that later, but for example, this is a study where we used fixed effects using the MPOG data. Okay, so let's talk about quasi-randomization. So that's giving the attending some IM succinylcholine. And, you know, I always like to say, you know, bottom line is, I think we all know as physicians that even if we're not doing formally randomized controlled trials, much of what determines whether a patient gets treatment A or B is random, right? So a lot of it comes down to attending preference, and for the most part, we're randomly assigned to our patients, right? Largely. Distance to the nearest hospital, given preferences and characteristics. So for all that the various healthcare systems try to brand themselves, right, the fact is the number one reason why a patient goes to a specific hospital is how far away they are. And then arbitrary cutoffs, right, we'll talk about in a second. And so, you know, quasi-randomization, you're attempting to use this randomness to isolate causal effects. So I'll just give you an example, like attending consultant preference. So, you know, I have not done a block since I finished residency, which... was a long time ago, or it feels like it was a long time ago, right? So, bottom line, I'm not really up for doing blocks, right? Now, one of my colleagues who do regional anesthesia, of course, they'll block anything that moves, literally, to make it not move, I guess. But, right, so let's think about what happens at night on call when we have a toe amp, all right? Like, I'm not going to do an ankle block. I mean, right, I haven't done one in a long time. I'm not a big fan of it, okay? So on call at night, right, that's a random case coming in, presumably a toe amp. Whether you got me or my regional colleague, right, we're randomly assigned, right? The call schedule said months in advance. Neither of us could have known this one toe amp was going to come in. So to that patient, it's completely random whether they get me or my regional colleague. But if they get my regional colleague, they're getting a block, right? If they get me, they're going to get a general anesthetic. Now, if you think about it, I just told you call's random. So the assignment of that patient to sort of getting a regional block or general anesthetic is kind of random. And again, MPOG records when cases were done, right? You can probably assume a case starting at 11 p.m. A toe amp is probably a case done on call. So again, you can see how MPOG, the richness of the data, allows you to sort of get a randomization that sort of occurs in real life. So various techniques. So instrumental variables is one you can do. So it's a fancy word. But basically, I like to think of instrumental variables as sort of being like maybe an inefficient clinical trial coordinator. So you have imagine you're a clinical trial coordinator, maybe a little inefficient. So even though a patient was supposed to be reassigned to the treatment arm, they kind of make mistakes. And so sometimes those patients end up in the control arm. So it's kind of like, well, more than likely, if the patient was supposed to be in the clinical in the treatment arm, they were in the treatment arm, but sometimes mistakes were made. Instrumental variables is kind of like that. It's basically identifying something, an instrument that affects whether a person's in the treatment, but which likely has no effect on outcomes. So Mark Newman, way back, did one. So again, distance to the nearest hospital, regional anesthesia capabilities. So that paper was looking at regional anesthesia for hip fracture. Again, the point being that when you get a hip fracture, you're taken to the nearest hospital, and that hospital may or may not have people who want to do regional anesthesia. So it's probably pretty random. I'll talk briefly about a paper that we published in Anesthesiology, looking at the number of nurse anesthetists and anesthesia assistants who are available to do cases on a given day. And so the idea is that this instrument is used to randomize patients. Regression discontinuity, so medicine is full of arbitrary cutoffs, right? I mean, we know that, right? So, my blood pressure, I guess, is like just close to the cutoff where they're supposed to treat me, but, it's just below, so I'm not on anything for it. I don't know if anyone has a firm cutoff on platelets in their institution, but you can imagine, an institution saying we won't put needles in people with platelets below 100K. The whole point of the regression discontinuity is that's an arbitrary cutoff, right? If you look at 100, if let's say that's a cutoff, you're not going to do blocks in people with platelets less than 100,000. Well, we all know there's no difference between a patient with a platelet count of 95 and a patient count of 105, right? I mean, in fact, that difference is probably within measurement error on when you were taking the count, right? So a regression discontinuity, in effect, would compare people around that arbitrary cutoff, right? Assuming it's the basic assumption is that people on this side of the cutoff and people on that side are basically the same. So again, MPOG contains a lot of data that would help you, exploit that. Again, date, time of surgery. So again, you can identify call cases. It has lab values, again, in cases where, arbitrary cutoffs are used to assign people to treatment or not treatment. So the anesthesia care team, so this is a paper we did way back, using instrumental variables, so just to give you a sense of what that's about. So in the United States, anesthesia care can be provided by a nurse anesthetist, an anesthesia assistant, or a physician. And so the question we were interested in, is there a difference in outcomes between nurse anesthetists and anesthesiologist assistants? And that has important policy implications because nurse anesthetists have authority to practice in all 50 states and the District of Columbia. Anesthesiologists assistants can only practice in 16 states and the district, and there's efforts to increase that number, but the argument is that anesthesiologist assistants are not as good basically as nurse anesthetists. Now, the key thing you might think to yourself is that you may assign cases differently to nurse anesthetists than the case that you perform the anesthesia assistants, right? And so that might confound any findings you have. And so for this paper, how we address this is we sort of exploited the daily variation in the ratio of anesthesiologists to nurse anesthetists. So for example, again, most of us know, on any given day, the number of anesthesiologist assistants or nurse anesthetists, it's determined by who's on call or post-call. It's determined by who decided to take a vacation that week or didn't, right? I think most, for both groups of people, full time is not 5 days a week, so it just determines on who was scheduled for that day and who wasn't. And that's all fairly random relative to the patient, right? So as a patient, if I roll into the hospital on a given day for my surgery, maybe on that day there are seven anesthesia assistants versus three nurse anesthetists because a bunch of nurse anesthetists were on call or sick or right post-call or weren't scheduled for that day. So every day there's variation, right? And that variation is unlikely to have anything to do with how sick I am as a patient or not. And so for this paper, we basically use that sort of variation, again, to as a randomization tool to get people to, we basically use it as a randomization tool in terms of getting a nurse anesthetist or an anesthesia assistant. So I guess the key takeaways here is retrospective data, retrospective analyses. I think they can add a lot of tremendous value. Again, you know, now that I'm on the policy side of things, I always find them, you know, for me actually, I value them at some level of the clinical trials because they are rooted in the real world. The key is obviously to find ways to deal with bias. One way to deal with bias is just to adjust for potential confounders, and the nice thing is the richness of the impact data allow the use of specific fixed effects to adjust for known unknowns and unknown unknowns. And another way is to consider real-life randomization, and again, MPOG data, I think, provide a lot of ways to exploit that. All right, well, thanks so much. Any questions?
From the audience, I'll respect the break as well. What is the one thing you wish you saw better data in MPOG, that you saw some of it, but not enough of it when you're trying to do the JAMA paper or the other work you're trying to do that would help us kind of target, help with these quasi-randomization things?
Yeah, well, so it's a great question because I addressed that in my upcoming talk. So not to spoil it, I think the two things in MPOG that could be better filled out are the diagnosis codes. I think that's the big one, actually, because for that paper, there are only 8 institutions that was consistently filled out. We're doing another paper now. It's a little bit better, but not much. I think it's up to 10. So that one. And the other one would be actually the surgical CPT code. That would be the biggest one, which I saw that has improved. So I do mention that. I don't have to give my next talk, but the surgical CPT code, I think that's because the surgical C allows me to know what the surgery is, right? So.
Thanks a lot. I think we'll take our break now, and we'll come back 15 minutes after we planned, so at 10:45. We'll reconvene at 10:45. Thank you, everybody.